Good evening, this is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720, and a most warm welcome to our distinguished guest tonight. We're joined once again by Mortimer J. Adler, America's most public and most serious public philosopher. Dr. Adler has just done a new book titled How to Think About God, A Guide for the 20th Century Pagan. And since the host of this program is, I fear, a 20th century pagan, this comes as a great boon. I've read the book, I'm excited about it, and I'm eager to get into that conversation with Mortimer Adler, and that will begin right after the usual update on the evening's news. Tonight, for the fourth time by my count on this program, Mortimer J. Adler, a distinguished figure in American intellectual life, a man who's remade many institutions, among them the University of Chicago, that back in the decade of the 30s and the early 40s, who went on to become the director of the Institute for Philosophical Research, which fortunately is located right here in Chicago, and has now had published his 24th or 25th? 27th book, and the name of that book, How to Think About God. It seems to me, Mortimer, we've worked from... we've worked on up, if I consider your four appearances, your last three and now this one. We talked first about Encyclopedia Britannica.
Right.
We then went on to talk about education. Mm-hmm. We then went on to talk about Mortimer Adler, increasing importance as we go from one topic to another. And we did that because you had done an excellent autobiography. And now we talk about God. And surely there is no more important subject than God.
None more important, no.
I must begin by telling you a story about a program we did perhaps only a month ago, at the most 2 months ago, about the very same question we're discussing tonight. Does God exist? And this was in the form of a debate between a Lutheran clergyman and an atheist, a lady who is a member of an organization called the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I wanted to get a good and full representation of the atheist point of view. She was quite lucid and quite articulate and a very interesting guest, but something surprised me in her presentation. She wasn't arguing directly against the existence of God. She was arguing merely that the Bible, the Old and the New Testaments, that the Bible as such is inconsistent and it represents God and, for that matter, Jesus as cruel in their demands upon us. And if that's what God is, then I choose not to believe in such an evil and such an inconsistent God. Though I tried to get her to talk beyond the question of Christianity and its representation in the Bible, somehow this for her was the ground on which the question of God's existence had to be fought.
That is obviously not a philosophical matter at all. And I'm sure that any good biblical scholar could handle her difficulties.
But for most of us, I suppose, the question of God's existence is very difficult to detach from particular religious traditions through which we've come to know the concept
that
of God.
Precisely is why I try to write this book as I did and called it A Guide for the 20th Century Pagan. Because in the history of thought about God in the West, after we leave the Greeks, the great tradition of theology is the Jewish, the Islamic, and the Christian tradition. The great theologians are all men of religion. And even coming into the modern world, great philosophers like Leibniz and Spinoza were believing Christians. And their thinking about God is not free from the coloration of their religious belief. On the other hand, when you come down to modern philosophers beginning in the 18th century with Hume and Kant, you have philosophers who try to deal with God purely by reason, and they do it negatively. They insist that reason is inadequate to establish the existence of God, whereas the religious philosophers go further than reason can go. They push reason beyond its bounds. What I tried to do was to stay strictly within the bounds of reason, not go beyond man's ordinary experience and his thinking ability, and nevertheless, with no aid from the light of religious faith, no dependent upon scripture, upon articles of faith or dogma, show that reason can, and I'm very careful now, I definitely eschew the word proof or demonstrate, because I don't think there's a proof of God's existence in the full mathematical sense of proof or demonstration. But I think there is an argument, and the book tries to develop an argument, which shows that there are rational grounds for believing that God exists, and the measure of that belief is it's beyond a reasonable doubt, which is not beyond a doubt. but beyond a reasonable doubt.
You have come to the conclusion, and we want to look at the logic that leads you to the conclusion, but you have come to the conclusion that God's existence is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right. But not beyond a doubt.
But not beyond a doubt. Therefore, if I gave you a multiple choice, does God exist, and offered you the following four alternatives, yes, no, probably, probably not, you would choose...
I'd say probably yes.
Probably yes.
But with a high probability. Beyond a reasonable doubt. See, in law, in courts of law, jury trials, beyond a reasonable doubt is that very high quantum of proof required in criminal cases, which is much more than by preponderance of the evidence. But either one, by the way, is satisfactory. I hope I can persuade my readers that I have established grounds for believing in God's existence beyond a reasonable doubt, but I'd be satisfied if they accepted it by a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, I propose that we shortly begin to go through at least the basic structure of the argument that you lay out in, of course, richer detail than we can do tonight, but that you lay out in this superb new book that I've just finished reading, How to Think About God, A Guide for the 20th Century Pagan. I want to say it's published by Macmillan, and I guess I must add that it isn't yet in Chicago bookstores, but
we'll
be in
another 5 or 10 days.
But I suppose those who are listening and want to get the book can write down the title, How to Think About God, and write down the publisher, Macmillan, and then wait for a week before they go in to buy it.
I don't know how they're going to wait. I mean, it's going to be very difficult for them to wait.
It's going to be very hard, I'm sure. Particularly after they've heard you discourse on this matter, or our discourse and your illuminations. Look, to begin with, and before we get into the logic, what difference does it make whether I believe that God exists or whether I don't believe that he exists? Assuming and granting that I have other grounds for aspiring to be more or less a moral man and meet my civic and private responsibilities with a certain amount of intelligence and decency, it doesn't really matter, does it, whether I believe in God?
I don't think I can answer that question simply by saying, no, it doesn't matter. Because the religious belief in God does make a difference to a lot of people. Belief in the immortality of the soul, in an afterlife, in divine rewards and punishment, in divine sanctions for the moral law. Certainly at a time when that was a widespread belief that affected the whole fabric of society. So it does make a difference. Now, then you say, what does the philosophical position, the purely philosophical position, do with respect to that? Well, I think it makes a difference that philosophy, using reason and experience alone, can give some credibility to the religious belief. I don't think it can support it entirely. In other words, as I hope we shall develop before the evening's over, there is a gap between what the philosopher can establish by reason and what the person of religious faith believes. But that gap is narrowed by the advance that reason can make toward it. There were philosophers in the Middle Ages who used to say, I believe even though it's absurd. Credo nisi absurdum est. And some went so far, Tertullian went so far as to say, I believe because it is absurd.
Yes.
Credo quia absurdum est. I think it's much better to say, I believe because it is not absurd. I believe because it's reasonable to believe.
But you don't believe for the reason that Miguel de Unamuno puts forward. I want to quote that to you.
No.
He says in his book, The Tragic Sense of Life, to believe in God is to yearn for his existence. And furthermore, it is to act as if he did exist. There's a passionate need for God, as reflected in that quotation. And that isn't really what brings you to this examination of the issue of God's existence.
My interest begins with the fact that God is a word in everyone's vocabulary. Everyone uses
God knows it is.
Yes. Everyone uses the word day in and day out, believers or non-believers. Everyone has, in some way, answer the question from
remember how Khrushchev used to confound us on his one trip over here?
Yes.
He was always using folk expressions with the word God in it, and he, of course, was the head of the communist state.
Not only do people use the word daily in and out, but I think everybody has an unconscious response to the question, does God exist, yes or no? Do you believe that God exists, yes or no? Do you think you have grounds for believing? And I think everyone who has any intellectual, shall I say, integrity at all, has some obligation to examine his own mind on the question. And what this book attempts to do for the layman, for the pagan particularly, is to help him examine his mind and find out what he is thinking, help him to think more clearly about how he uses the word God and how he would try to, if someone said, tell me, why do you think God exists, or why don't you think God exists? What grounds would you have for affirming or denying? That's a question everyone has to answer, and this book is a help to answering it.
Well, help me. And in so doing, as we do a bit of dialogue, we will reproduce at least the structure of the argument as given in How to Think About God. Let us imagine the Chicago equivalent of the Agora, and you are now cast as a modern Socrates, and I'm one of those rather presumptuous youths that Socrates was always setting right. What is the Chicago equivalent of the Agora, by the way?
I don't know. I suppose it's... Unfortunately, we don't have one equivalent of that.
A place out in the sun where people sit down and just chat. It should be one of our parks, but that's dangerous.
Can't we do it without the Agora?
We'll do it without that. At any rate, I say to you, no, I truly don't believe in God. I wish I did, in a way. Life seems simpler and perhaps even happier for those who do. But I do not see God in operation. I believe in a material universe.
Well, why don't we begin by examining the meaning of the word God?
All right.
Because otherwise, what are we talking about?
Well, if I assert I do not believe in God, then you have got every right to ask me, what do I mean by God?
I certainly do. And I have to ask you in the first place, as don't you recognize, when you use the word God, you're using a proper name. You're using a name like John Smith or Milton Rosenberg or Mortimer Adler. You're naming, whether it exists or not, Hamlet names a singular person that is an imaginary character. God may be an imaginary character or a real one like Milton Rosenberg. So that, in any case, though, it has the character of a proper name, not a common name like cat, dog, or house. Now, when you use proper names, there are only two ways in which you can use them. You either have to be introduced as the person who bears the name. To get someone to use the name Milt Rosenberg properly, I say, look, there's Milt Rosenberg. Shake his hand. You recognize me when you see him. That's introduction, acquaintance. But I use the proper name George Washington. You never met George Washington. I can't introduce you to him. So what do I do about making that proper name familiar to you or usable? I say, George Washington, the first president of the United States of America. Well, that identifies. That's what's known as a definite description.
That locates him in the chronology.
Mother, that definite description pins down that one thing in the whole universe.
That was his attribute and his alone. He was indeed the only first president
of the United States. And therefore, George Washington is given that designative meaning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, when we use the word God, to whom you can't be introduced, with whom you can't have a direct acquaintance.
Well, according to a good deal of contemporary evangelical doctrine, you can and do.
Remember now, we're dealing with pagans who don't have faith.
True.
Remember now, yes, there were many persons who thought they met God in the person of Jesus on earth, and Moses thought he met God but we're outside the realm of faith now. Right? In the realm of ordinary experience and reason, you are not acquainted with God, and you have to come to the meaning of God by a definite description, not by acquaintance, right?
And indeed, I am personally and truly not on that basis acquainted with God. I've never encountered him in my own emotional
life. Nor are you likely to.
No, I suppose.
Therefore, I must introduce you to him with a definite description. Now, here, my first great help is an extraordinary Archbishop of Canterbury in the 11th century, Anselm, this is an extraordinary invention, who faced this question and said, it's almost in this tone of voice that he's saying, if you are trying to think about God, must you not be thinking of that than which no greater can be thought of?
This is the key.
We must
conceive God as
I am ticklish about words.
I'm jumping.
You can't say conceive. The word conceive is there's no concept of God, and there's no definition of God. Well, we're going to come to that. You have to, and that's why modern physics is so important.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to digress for a moment. Only in modern physics, modern nuclear physics, and in modern cosmology, have we discovered that empirical concepts drawn from experience are not the only furniture of the mind. We have theoretical constructs, hypothetical entities we construct in our minds. God is like that. You can't draw from experience an empirical conception of God.
Then you're coming to this point. to the kind, to the point in discourse where you would say to me, let us agree that when we speak of God, we mean the following.
But let us agree that we're going to formulate now a definite description which will characterize the construction in our minds, the notion. We're going to construct a notion of God. And here Anselm says the first step is to recognize you're thinking of the Supreme Being. If you're not thinking of the Supreme Being, you're not thinking of God. And what do you mean by the Supreme Being? That being than which no greater can be thought of. Then Anselm takes the next step. And it's an extraordinary step. If you are thinking of that than which nothing greater can be thought of, must you not think of that being as one that really exists? And the answer is yes. Because if that being of which you are thinking exists only in your mind and not outside your mind really, it is not as great as a being which existed both in your mind and outside your mind in reality as that chair over there exists. Why? Because that which has real existence over and above merely mental or ideal existence has more power and action. Therefore, says Anselm, when you are thinking of that in which nothing greater can be thought of, you must be thinking of that which really exists. He made an error which I want to correct. It does not follow that because you must think of God as really existing, that God must really exist. The second must doesn't follow from the first.
This is a very important point in your argument as you develop it in the book, How to Think About God. Yeah. There are lots of other theologians, some of them of earlier times, and some modern theologians, who settle essentially for St. Anselm's proof and say, since God is defined as that being than which no greater can be thought of, would not be utterly great if he lacked existence. Clearly he has existence, ergo...
He exists.
We have proved the existence of God. That doesn't satisfy
you. That's a complete non sequitur. All you have said is, when I think of the Supreme Being, or the being than which no greater can be thought of, I must think. The must is on the word think. I must think of that being as really existing. The question is, does the being I'm thinking of really exist? Still an open question, you see. But Anselm went a step further. And that is to say, not only must that being be thought of as really existing, but also as one that never came into existence or passed away, for a transient being, one that had only a temporary being,
would not be as great as one that were eternal.
Therefore, we have now two properties about construction. Now, you can go further than that. And I went further than Anselm, I think, by a device that I'm very proud of. I asked myself the question, if God exists, if the Supreme Being exists... And remember, there's an if there. I'm not begging any questions. What is that existence like?
Now, is this a moment when we can, as I fear we must, pause for some commercials? That, you know, in this radio game, they look for what they call hookers or hangers or something like that. You raise a very exciting question, and then you interpolate the commercials, and the answer is deferred till after those.
Right.
So let's restate the question.
All right.
Restate the question for me as our as our hooker.
The question is, if God exists, what is God's existence like?
And for the answer, you'll have to wait two or three minutes.
Another opportunity for tax-deferred savings is being offered by Tolman Home Federal Savings. The tax-deferred Tolman Home Annuity earns tax-deferred interest at a highly competitive rate compounded daily. Not one penny of your earnings is used to pay current taxes, so all your interest remains in the account to compound and grow. You pay no taxes on your interest earnings until that interest is withdrawn, and you can choose from a variety of payout options. Now, your money is always available, though some cases may require an early withdrawal penalty or fee. The Tolman Home Annuity is issued by GNA, Great Northern Insured Annuity Corporation, Seattle, Washington, and offered through Tolman Home Investments. You can make an initial deposit of $5,000 or more and add to it whenever you like. Open your annuity at any of Tolman Home's 55 financial centers in Chicago and Central Illinois.
Beautiful music. Soft, quiet music to travel by. Traveling home to Town and Country Cadillac, where right now you can buy, you can lease, you can save $6,000 and more on select new and executive-driven 1984 Cadillacs. Town and Country on Farnsworth Avenue, just off the East-West Tollway in Aurora. just 10 minutes away from Naperville and 15 minutes from St. Charles and Wheaton. And if you live in Oak Brook or Downers Grove, you're only 20 minutes away from saving $6,000 or more on the best selection of new and executive-driven 1984 Cadillacs this side of Joliet, Elmhurst, Chicago, or Elgin. Which, by the way, are just 30 minutes from our door. Town and Country Cadillac on Farnsworth Avenue, right off the East-West Tollway in Aurora. Come home to Town and Country Cadillac, the very close, very quiet Cadillac people.
Throughout our school, there's one promise made.
We're gonna save
air conditionings and fans? If you don't, Sears does. All Sears window air conditioners, central air systems, and portable fans in stock are on sale now. Window units from compact bedroom portables to powerhouse multi-room coolers, all $30 to $80 off. All Sears high-efficiency central systems reduce $300. Sears better central air system, priced as low as $499. Who's got air conditioning and fans to keep you cool? Stop in at any Sears Chicagoland store, and you'll know. And we return to this recorded edition of Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg. Milt?
And we return to Mortimer J. Adler, director of the Institute for Philosophical Research, author most recently of the brand new book, How to Think About God, that just published by Macmillan. We've come, I think, Mortimer, to this point. Reasonable men talking with one another about God would come necessarily to the meaning for that word God, a meaning something like this, a being or an entity that is greater than all others that we can think of or talk of, and that greatness necessarily would include existence and eternality. But that...
In our minds.
In our minds.
That's right. We must think of them
but
that way.
Not necessarily yet in reality. That is not yet demonstrated.
That's right.
Something else is required. Further philosophical,
right.
Logical analysis is required. And the key to what is still required is the question you were saying a while ago, if God exists, what is his existence like?
Now,
let me understand that question.
I'm really trying to carry Anselm's method of thinking about God a little further than Anselm carried it. That question, by the way, has only three possible answers. And I'm going to eliminate two and show you that the third answer is the only possible answer.
One possible answer is he doesn't have any existence.
No. You can't beg. The question starts with if God exists. We're only saying if God exists. You can't say God doesn't.
No, I can't. Quite true. That's ruled out.
If God exists, what is God's existence? We're only trying to find out how we must think about God.
All right.
I want to postpone. Let's keep the thing in two separate parts. First, how we must understand our use of the word God, what notion we have in mind. Then the question is, have we any basis for affirming that there exists in reality something that corresponds to that notion? Keep the second step out for the moment, please. Right? Now, back to the first question. There's only three possible answers to the question, what is God's existence like if God exists? It's either totally unlike, either essentially like everything else that we know to exist, or totally unlike the existence of everything else, or partly like and partly unlike. That's exhaustive. It can't be essentially like, because essentially like God...
Wouldn't be much of a God if it were.
It would be material, finite, perishable, mutable. Would not be that thing which... So therefore, it is not essentially like. It can't be totally unlike either, because we said, if God exists, so at least there's some... The one point of similarity between God, as you're thinking of him, and everything else, is they share real existence in our minds. You take that one property, and you say that God is both like and unlike, like only in having existence, and negatively, that existence is immaterial, immutable. Think of all the negatives. Immutable, infinite, unconditioned, independent. Notice every one of those is negative. I can't think positively of God's properties now. I'm saying the only thing I can say positively is God, I must think of God as really existing, and that real existence is, now the negatives again, immaterial, immutable, imperceptible, infinite, unconditioned, uncaused, independent. The one word that sums that up, that's a wonderful word, is the word aseity. Everything which exists either has its existence in, through, or from itself.
And one of the reasons I know you love that word is that you made it up.
That's right. Oh, no, I think I got it somewhere, but it's a lovely word in any case. Everything that exists...
I heard you say the other day that it's a word of your invention.
I'd like to think so. I hope I'm right about that. Everything that exists either exists in, through, or from itself, or in, through, or from another. That which exists in, through, or from another exists ab alio, from another. That which exists in, through, or from itself exists a se. And therefore, since you say God exists in, through, and from himself, you say God has aseity. God is the only being I must think of as having aseity. Now, those are all the properties. The most important, then, are the properties that God is independent, unconditioned, and uncaused, those negative existence, and infinite. The proof that God's existence is infinite, not quantitatively infinite, is that God is not a member of any class. Everything else you can think of, every other proper name you can think of, is a singular that belongs to a class of which there are other members.
It's curious, of course. You've got a great interest in and deep grounding in classical literature and classical thought. And if you look at the evolution of our concept of God, he once did not have independence and uniqueness. To the contrary, there were gods. Yeah, there was a pantheon of gods.
They were not doing what Anselm asked them to do, thinking of that, there was nothing greater can be thought of. Because with two, that it doesn't work. So that, let's suppose for a moment now that we have that much of a clear notion of what we mean by the word God. Now, the next step is, how does one establish the existence of anything? This is a logical question. Before we come to the question of how you argue for God's existence, you have to say, well, how do you establish the existence of anything? We'll think, for example, now, again, of a jury trial. A particular event that took place, a murder or a theft, the evidence is given. The jury hears pieces of evidence and infers the existence in terms of that evidence.
Well, I know that Mortimer Adler exists because
perception.
He's sitting across
That's
the table
right.
from me, and I've known him for a few years. And so
my existence
I know
is evident.
I know that George Washington exists because
historical
authoritative
evidence.
Documents have told
Testimony.
Me about him, and I believe
That's
him.
Right. Now then, with respect to God, what kind of evidence do you have for existence? Here, now my second great help from the past comes from an extraordinary English philosopher at Oxford, William of Ockham. You've heard of Ockham's razor.
Oh, of course.
Well, Ockham's razor is the negative aspect of Ockham's rule. Ockham's razor says, negatively, you are not entitled to posit the existence of any hypothetical entity, unless you absolutely need, that hypothetical entity to explain the phenomena that are in front of you. Conversely, the positive aspect of Occam's razor is Occam's rule. When you need to posit the existence of a hypothetical entity to explain the phenomena, you are entitled to do so. This is the rule that the physicist uses when, what's the evidence for the existence of black holes? You don't perceive black holes. I mean, you're never going to meet one, I assure you. It is that the phenomena that, the detectable phenomena can only be explained by that hypothetical entity as a construct. You say, I affirm the existence of a black hole because the astronomical phenomena, the cosmological phenomena that I registered in my observatory can't be explained any other way. When a physicist affirms the existence of a neutrino, which no one's ever going to see, he's saying, that theoretical construct, neutrino, hypothetically in my mind, I affirm the existence of, because by affirming it, I explain something in a cloud chamber.
Relevant to this is a quotation from Einstein that I've seen cited often, who says, quote, God is a necessary hypothesis.
Well, that's exactly the same point. It is a hypothesis that you make. You
But why is it a necessary hypothesis?
That's the next
Einstein
question.
Isn't around
that's
for me to ask, so I'm asking
question.
You. Yeah, why is God a necessary hypothesis?
Be a little more patient now, Mel. All I've done now is establish the logic of the argument. I'm saying that the reasoning by which I'm now going to argue for God's existence is exactly the same. That's the important point. Exactly the same kind of reasoning that our modern cosmologists use, and that our modern nuclear or elementary physicists use when they establish the existence or affirm, posit, the word is posit, the existence of a hypothetical entity needed to explain the phenomena.
So that requires then that we point up some phenomena cannot be explained unless we posit God.
The only word I have to criticize there, because I now have to pass from physics to theology, is the word phenomena. The next point involved is to know what question you must ask, to which the only possible answer is God. But before I get to that, I have to say, make two negative points. In the history of the subject, there have been two grievous errors, and made by some of the very best minds. One is the supposition that the world began, that the world actually had a beginning.
Well, we have that from the Bible, from the opening words of the Bible.
But that's an article of faith. St. Thomas, who was a Christian, a very good one, I learned this from Aquinas, in the 13th century, in one of the great disputations in the University of Paris, he argued against the Latin averroists, who, depending on Aristotle, argued for the eternity of the world. And he said, who thought they could prove the eternity of the world was everlasting. Aquinas' position was
time without end, etc.
Time without beginning or end.
Or end.
Aquinas said, as a matter of Christian faith, I believe the world had a beginning, because it says in Scripture, Genesis 1, in the beginning, God. But as a philosopher, no one can prove either that the world began or the world did not begin. That is beyond reason's ability. So if I'm a philosopher, I've got to assume either one or the other, and no grounds at all to determine my assumption. Now notice, since I'm free to assume either, I can't prove either. If I assume that the world began, had a real beginning, came into being out of nothing initially, I've assumed God's existence, because if that happened, God had to exist to create it, right? Therefore, to argue for God's existence logically and fairly, I must make the more difficult assumption. I must assume that the world never had a beginning, will never have an end.
And if I can show that that conception also requires the presence of God.
That's it. That's the hard one. I've got to make the task as hard for myself as possible.
Right.
I've got to assume an eternal, everlasting cosmos that has no beginning and end, and still show that God is needed.
Mm-hmm.
I must posit God. Now the second error that I want to avoid, because these are very clarifying. And this is even more common than the error of saying that you prove God's existence by saying, well, if he didn't exist, how did the world begin? It's connected with this is the terrible notion of God as the first cause.
The prime mover, yes.
First cause. When you say that, you are thinking of a prime mover or a first cause connotes or implies a second, a third, a fourth. There either is a series of causes of which God is first, and God moves a second cause, and a second cause moves a third cause, or a set of causes horizontally, not in time.
Well, not necessarily. God, in this kind of discourse, is defined as the mover unmoved, or might then say, the cause uncaused.
But I'm only talking now, you're changing the words. I said first. We must not think of God as first cause, because there's nothing first about it. The thing I learned from Aquinas is that God, this is a matter of thinking, if you think of God as a cause of any effect, God must be the sole and only cause of that effect, and causing not through any intermediaries, but immediately.
Well, I agree. At least that would be a God worth believing in.
Well, that's the
that
only...
would be a God worth taking seriously.
That's right.
How do we come to demonstration?
I'm removing garbage first. I'm removing the garbage of assuming a world that began. I'm removing the garbage of first cause.
You are pushing aside the detritus.
That's right. Now then, what question is it? Maybe I ought to make one other point. Since I've assumed that the cosmos, the physical cosmos, is eternal, I'm assuming that it had no cause of its coming into being. And it's not a part of any whole, so it's unconditioned, it's independent. Why don't I identify God with... Why don't I make the mistake that Spinoza made of identifying God with the physical cosmos? There are three possibilities. Either God is a part of the cosmos, or the cosmos is a part of God, or God and the cosmos are identical, right?
Many make that transformation, whether it's error-laden or not, when they say God is nature. Nature is God.
I want to remove that error. More detritus.
Yet others, including, say, Paul Tillich, to speak of modern theologians, are interested in that aspect of total reality which involves sort of organic sensibility, and they settle for a definition of God. You remember Tillich's definition, God is the ground of being.
Well, that's...
being, that, existence, is that which partakes of God, and God is in it or of him.
What I'm going to do, I hope, makes Tillich's cloudy notion clearer. I think Tillich, being a German, is very cloudy. All German thinkers are cloudy, in my judgment.
Even if they taught at the University of Chicago.
Yes. But I think I can make sense of that extraordinary phrase, ground of being, and give it better sense than Tillich gave it. Pardoning my irreverence. Let me get back to the question. I want to get rid of Spinoza, too, as an adversary.
We'll take care of all these boys.
That's right.
Good.
First place. Obviously, if the universe is a totality, the cosmos is a totality, it can't be part of God, because the whole can't be part of anything else. And if God is that, then there's nothing ready to be conceived. God can't be part of the universe. And God can't be identical with the cosmos, because the cosmos is not that, then there's nothing ready to be conceived. You can, any cosmos, physical cosmos you can think of a greater. Hence God, and that's the answer to the question about God in relation to the cosmos.
In fact, in physical extension, it gets greater every second, because it keeps expanding.
That's right. Now then, what is the question that requires us to posit God's existence? I'm going to, there have been, I think, incorrect arguments for God's existence, I'm going to take the wrong questions first before I lead you up to the one right question.
We're still getting rid of things.
That's right.
All right.
Many people say, well, you come to God by asking the question, why does the universe, why does the cosmos have the structure and shape it now has? There are many answers to that question other than God. You don't have to posit God to answer that question. The physicists can answer that question.
Well, they have indeed handled it from the moment of the Big Bang on. They can give a pretty good theoretical reconstruction of how it happened physically.
That's right. You don't need God. When natural causes and natural explanations do, you don't have to posit God. Remember Occam now. Whenever you can find any other thing to do, don't posit it.
You know, an alternative to the book of Genesis, written by a modern physicist, would be Steven Weinberg's book, The First Three Minutes.
That's right.
Which gives you a full physical theoretical account.
For everything happens since the Big Bang.
Everything that's happened since.
That's right. Now then.
Since over the last 20 billion years.
20 or 18 or 14. The various
figures. The estimate has just been lowered from 14. 20 to 15.
That's
probably,
right. Yeah. Yes, I know. Another question that has led to a wrong answer. Why do you and I exist? And that, by the way, has led to the most serious mistake that I think I can show to be a mistake. One of the arguments for God's existence is that you and I have a contingent existence. You come into being and pass away. There's nothing necessary about your existence. And therefore, you need God to explain your existence. I think I really made an invention or a discovery when I said that the principle of inertia applies in the realm of being as well as in the realm of motion. Now, you know, Aristotle was wrong about motion. He thought that when the billiard cue, if I may, there were no billiards in Aristotle's day, but when something pushed a ball on a table, the ball did not go by itself, but the thing that pushed it had to continue to push it, either by a column of air or something, that the ball's motion required a continual causal action on the ball. Well, what Galileo discovered is, set the ball in motion, have no opposing force stop it, it will go on endlessly. Or at rest, it stays at rest endlessly unless it's set in motion. So I say, your father and mother brought you into being. If they are dead, as my father and mother did, they obviously aren't causing my existence now. So if you say, what causes my existence now? My answer is inertia. When something is brought into being, it perseveres in being until counteracting causes efficaciously cause it to cease to be, right? So you don't need God to explain your continuing being or my continuing. We are in our continuation in being, our perseverance in being is inertia.
So we're working towards this clarification. What then do we need God for?
So
that we can get a proper explanation of something that otherwise cannot be explained.
That's the next step.
And we're going to take that next step after we take these intermediate steps.
Right.
By satellite from Los Angeles, I'm Tom McKee, sponsored by Payne Weber and Sears Roebuck and Company. The first bout tonight for an American at the Memorial Sports Arena. Dan Lovett, what happened?
Paul Gonzalez, Tom, the light flyweight from here in Los Angeles, cut his British opponent John Lyon under the left eye first round, then bloodied his nose real good in the second. But the kid from Liverpool stayed with him despite the repeated sticking left jabs that Gonzalez delivered. By the end, the Brit had eaten a lot of leather. It's a split decision, though, as Gonzalez moves into the semifinals here in L.A.
That means, of course, now that U.S. boxers have clinched at least four medals in this 23rd Olympiad, much to the dismay, we should add, of the South Koreans, who earlier threatened to leave the Games because of what it claims is unfair judging. They have since apparently changed their mind, and everybody is friends again. This is ABC Sports.
Gee, they're picking the winning lottery number on TV.
The winning number is 754.
Ooh, that could be me. Yeah, yeah. Oops, there's the phone. Hello?
Randy Hughes?
Yes, did I win?
You're about to.
How do you know? Is this the lottery?
This is the IRS, and believe me, we know.
Uh-oh.
We're right behind you.
Oh. Before they call you, you should call a Payne Weber specialist who will help you and your accountant choose a tax shelter investment that's best for you.
So where's the money you won?
Payne Weber got here first.
No,
Sears gives you more power now during Craftsman Power Week. Save 50% on a Craftsman variable speed reversible drill or a Craftsman saber saw. Just $39.99 each. Save 50% on a Craftsman 60-piece tool set. And save $80 on Sears' best Craftsman half-horsepower garage door opener, now $179.99. Our lowest price of the year. Hundreds of powerful savings are on now through Saturday at Sears retail stores.
There's more for your life at Sears.
In this rapidly changing world, there are those rare certain things that never seem to go out of style. They're called traditional. They're called classics. They're called Cadillacs. Your Chicagoland Cadillac dealer has a special opportunity for you to make a classic deal on a previously owned Cadillac. Strong sales in Chicago have resulted in a tremendous selection of previously owned Cadillacs. And right now, your Cadillac dealers are offering classic deals on these classic cars, but only for a limited time. Think about it. A previously owned Cadillac has all the qualities that are inherent in all Cadillacs. Lasting value and luxurious standard features not found in ordinary cars. Yet a previously owned Cadillac oftentimes costs less than many new cars. Thousands of dollars less. So see your Chicagoland Cadillac dealer today and make a classic deal on a previously owned Cadillac before your opportunity to invest slips away.
Who is Scott Peterson?
I'll give you a hint. Ready? Delicatessen.
Who is Scott Peterson?
Need another hint? Okay. Polish sausage.
Scott Peterson.
I think you've got it now.
Scott Peterson makes the best deli in town.
For years, Scott Peterson's been making smoked sausage, including our famous smoked Polish, for deli counters at Chicago's finest grocery stores. Now it's in your grocer's meat case. Deli counter quality packages of Scott Peterson smoked sausage. It's made fresh in Chicago from hand-trimmed cuts of meat, smoked naturally and oh so slowly. Way, so it tastes like it came from a deli, not from a package.
Scott Peterson makes the best deli in town.
Look for deli counter quality packages of Scott Peterson sausage in your grocer's meat case.
Do you suffer from emphysema or other respiratory problems? With Chicagoland Respiratory Care on the job, you can breathe easier. Chicagoland Respiratory Care, 5911 North Clark, is the individualized home care company, offering delivery and setup of oxygen concentrators, respiratory therapy equipment, beds, walkers, commodes, wheelchairs, and other medical supplies, plus home visits by a credentialed respiratory therapist. Phone 769-5913. 769-5913. Chicagoland Respiratory Care salutes the respiratory therapist of Illinois during National Respiratory Week, August 26th through September 1st. And now we return to this recorded edition of Extension 720. Milt Rosenberg will be back live tomorrow night, but tonight's program is taped, and the callers you will hear on the air are those who called in when the program was first broadcast in the spring of 1980. Now, here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
Our good friend Mortimer Adler is, as usual, engaging in an heroic feat tonight. Before my eyes and into your very ears, he is, with utter lucidity, reviewing the essential skeletal structure of the argument that is far more fully and with greater detail developed in his new book, How to Think About God. And you've now shown me what to mean by the notion of God. You've now shown me how we can get rid of a lot of obfuscations, particularly on the question of prior proofs of God's existence. And we've come to, and we've been dealing with the question of, if God exists, what is his existence like? And in the process, we have raised the question of what in reality, as we apprehend reality, requires us, because otherwise it would be a total enigma,
right,
what requires us to posit God.
Right.
And you have said we are not required to posit God as a way of accounting for the origin of this universe.
Or its shape and form.
Or its shape and form.
Or your or my existence.
Nor are we required to posit God for the existence of mere mortals like Adler and Rosenberg.
Right.
And the 4 billion others who are around,
right,
at the moment, or who have ever been or will ever be.
Right.
What then do we need the concept for?
The question to which the only possible answer is God is the question, why is there something rather than nothing?
Now, I love that, and I loved it when I encountered it, yeah, in your book, because the concept of nihil, of nothing,
that's right,
is the key to the final step in your analysis.
Absolutely. And by the way, that leads to two wonderful words, annihilation and exnihilation. We know there's something. The cosmos exists. Now, we know something else about the cosmos that every contemporary philosopher and scientist would admit. It is not just orderly. It's full of chaos and chance and disorder. It is a possible cosmos, and the other possible cosmoses are conceivable.
It's a great trick in science fiction sometimes,
well,
to posit other cosmoses,
right,
which coexist
and,
with
and
others.
By the way, a great theologian like Aquinas said there are many possible worlds, but there's only one. Now, when something is merely possible, it also is capable of not existing. A merely possible cosmos, which actually exists, is one that need not have existed and need not exist right now. It has in itself no reason for its existence.
At least it was not inevitable.
That's right. Now, therefore, since it is and is not inevitable, it needs right now, at this very moment, a cause of its continuing existence.
Existence.
Ex-nihilation could either be creative or preservative. It is creative when it brings into being something out of nothing. It is preservative when it keeps in being that which otherwise would be reduced to nothing. So God is the ex-nihilating, preservative cause of a cosmos which, without that cause in action, would at this moment cease to be.
But if you want to posit God as the preservative cause, why aren't you required, or at least why aren't you tempted, to as well posit him as the original creative cause?
That's the next step. But, you see, the strongest step is the one that is based upon the hotter assumption, namely that the world has always existed. Once I posit God as the preservative cause of the cosmos that exists, I then can say, if it's a merely possible cosmos, it may not have existed always. In which case, God was its creative cause as well as its present preservative cause. That's a weaker step, but I'm willing to add it. I'm quite satisfied to stay with the strongest step, that since the world does exist at this very moment and need not exist at this very moment, I posit as the explanation of its there being something rather than nothing, the existence of an infinite being, for only an infinite being could ex-nihilate anything. You and I have never seen either of two things in the whole of nature, and no one will ever see them. No one will ever see annihilation or ex-nihilation, because you never saw anything come into being out of nothing. Nor have you ever seen anything reduced to nothingness. What we call annihilation is mere destruction, transformation, house burned down, a city is destroyed, it becomes debris and ashes and wind and whatnot.
And Mortimer, I've got to interrupt you to tell you about yet another conversation we had on this program. It's quite relevant to what we're now talking about. David Schramm, now the chairman of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Chicago, was on this program a little bit less than a year ago, on the occasion of Einstein's centenary, as a matter of fact, when I press him on the very same issues how do we account for the origin of the universe, the maintenance of the universe, and so on, his answer is, we can account for it by laws that we have discovered and others that we have not yet discovered but will discover. And when I then say, yes, but is not God the source ultimately of, and this is the argument in terms of creation, he says, we don't know and we can't ever find out.